Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. With me today to discuss the election results and what they mean for the future is Matt Bennett. Matt's the co-founder and senior vice president of Third Way, a think tank oriented around the political center. Matt also has extensive past political experience, including work as a deputy assistant to President Bill Clinton and the communications director for the Clark for President campaign in 2004. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start by having you tell us a little bit about Third Way. Why and how did you start this organization?
Sure. Third Way is a think tank in Washington. We have about 40 people. As you say, we occupy the center left of the political spectrum. We were founded in the immediate aftermath of the 2004 election, which was a very bad election for Democrats. Not just the Kerry loss, but Democrats had lost 7 out of 8 Senate seats, and all 7 candidates who lost had been moderates who just didn't feel like they had a home in the Democratic Party. We occupy the space in the political spectrum that the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, used to, and we do work on a wide range of policy issues.
Now, have you ever had thoughts or conversations in your organization about becoming more explicitly bipartisan, or are you comfortable staying Democratic, although at the center?
No, we've had those discussions. All of us who work at Third Way come out of Democratic politics. And our view is there are some groups that occupy the center. There's the Bipartisan Policy Center. There are some other groups that are truly bipartisan. The problem is that Washington is a tribal town, and it is hard to make impact and hard to make progress if you are not trusted by people on one side or the other. And if you're truly bipartisan, that's a tough one to do.
And are you focusing on any particular issues in the last year or so there at the organization?
Well, unfortunately, Washington is pretty locked down in the last year or so, not only because of the election, but because of kind of the gridlock that's hit Congress. So we haven't been pushing anything on the Hill. We do a wide range of work on fiscal issues, on the economy generally, on economic growth, on entitlement reform, on trade, on national security, energy, and social issues like gay marriage and abortion.
Well, we're here to talk about the election, so let's get to it. Let's start with the results. Was there anything that surprised you in the election results or anything that surprised you on the night of the election?
Well, obviously, the kind of magnitude of the Obama victory and the outcome in the Senate races were pretty surprising and gratifying for those of us who were supporters of the president. As we are beginning to sift through the data, which is coming out slowly, the way exit polls work, they release a little bit of data right at the outset, and then much more comes out later. They're starting to see some relatively surprising things about the nature of the Obama coalition. Of course, we know that he lost white men by a lot, by 27 points from the initial data, and that he increased his support among Hispanics. He won them by 44% this time, which was up from 36% in 08. But there are a couple of actually surprising things about this election that are big takeaways for us. One is that this is the first election in 3 decades where culture issues or a set of culture issues actually benefited Democrats. There really wasn't a culture issue on the ballot in 2008. Obama won that race because a variety of factors, the economic collapse, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Before that, there had been cycle after cycle of presidential politics where culture issues had helped Republicans. So in 2004, gay marriage was on ballots in 18 states, many of them battlegrounds. All of them went for the Republicans, and that helped with Republican turnout. In 2000, it was guns. In 1996, it was partial birth abortion. In 1992, it was term limits. In 1988, it was crime. And in 1984, it was welfare, which Reagan had turned into a culture issue. All of those had helped Republicans. This time, the amazing thing is that the culture issues, a suite of issues relating to women, particularly women's health and abortion, but also equality for gays and lesbians, those issues helped the Democrats. And in the ballot initiatives on gay marriage this time, all 4 of them that were on the ballot passed, including 2 in states where it had failed before. So there's been a pretty big shift on culture issues. That was a big surprise.
Now, you say at the beginning there of your answer, the magnitude of the victory surprised you. Was this a big victory? I mean, I guess in one sense, if you look at the Electoral College, it was pretty comfortable, but those were a series of pretty small wins in each state. Now, granted, you accumulate all those small wins, but looked at it from another way, was this not pretty close, even though it wasn't this all-night thing that some people had expected?
Right. It's all about expectation in politics. Certainly, it was not the sweeping popular vote victory that he won in 2008, but nobody expected it to be. He did exceed expectations by winning every single swing state, with the possible exception of Florida. I didn't ever regard North Carolina as a swing state. So that was one big surprise. The other is that in many of the swing states, he won by comfortable or reasonably comfortable margins, 5, 6, 8 points. And that was surprising. So I think the Electoral College votes that he racked up combined with some fairly decent wins in the swing states was the thing that kind of jumped off the page.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Matt Bennett, Senior Vice President at Third Way Political Think Tank in Washington, D.C. Well, obviously, the big question is, what now? And I've got a couple specific questions in that vein. First, on their face, the results seem to be, on the whole, if you think about Congress as well, a recipe for more of the same in Washington. But the president did suggest in his victory speech that he was going to make some changes toward more compromise. He challenged in a very subtle way, I thought, Republicans to do the same. So what reason do we have to hope that is going to be a change, to combine two words from a past campaign?
That's a really good question. And, of course, you're right that we have, after a two-year, $3 billion divisive campaign, ended up with pretty much the status quo. The House has changed slightly. Of course, the congressman from Syracuse is going to be different. There are some new Democrats in the Senate, but you basically have the same thing, Republicans in control of the House solidly, and Democrats now solidly control of the Senate and the White House. So the question is, what will be different now? And the answer is, we don't know for sure. There have been some good signs since the election so far. We're only, less than 48 hours out. But Speaker Boehner, for instance, in the day after the election, did make some different kinds of noises about revenue in the discussions they're about to have over the fiscal cliff. And as you point out, the president was extending an olive branch in his victory speech. So our hope and expectation is that given the magnitude of the difficulties and the enormity of the danger that faces the country if they don't reach some sort of compromise in the fiscal cliff, will force both sides, like it or not, to compromise. And they only have 56 days to do it, and they better get going.
But on that point, though, I mean, you could argue that we have faced those moments where you would think that reality would dictate something, and it doesn't. Or at least it's very much last minute in a way that has harmful effects on the economy. So why are you confident that the reality is going to force this?
Well, I think, for one thing, the clock is ticking in more loudly this time. Second is that everyone has oxes that are about to get gored by the fiscal cliff. In the negotiations, for example, in the summer of 2011 over the debt ceiling, kind of unbelievably, the Republicans professed not to care if we broke through the debt ceiling and if America defaulted on its debt. And they didn't feel that they had their feet to the fire in any way, that Democrats who cared about good government were the only ones who had pressure on them to deal. This time, it's very clear that Republican priorities are at stake here as well as Democratic ones. And so both sides have kind of an impetus to come to the table. And we hope that it'll be different. I think there's one other thing also. Republicans just lost a big national election where the thing almost at the forefront of the debate between Romney and Obama was this approach to fiscal questions. And there is no doubt, looking at the exit poll data, that the majority of Americans believe that new revenue has got to be part of the solution. And I think that's why you're starting to hear different sounds coming out of Republican leaders.
Is there any kind of different set of resources that President Obama can draw on this time as well that the election gave him or that simply being in a second term gives him?
Yes. I don't think what you'll see is Obama claiming some kind of mandate. I think that his people have studied the lesson of George W. Bush pretty carefully. What Bush did right after his inauguration in 2005 was claim a mandate and try to privatize Social Security, and he lost convincingly, and it really destroyed his second-term domestic agenda. Obama will not repeat that mistake, and so he will be relatively humble about the extent to which he has a mandate. However, he's a lame duck now, and he has much more room to maneuver. He does not have to be as responsive to the members of his own coalition, which allows him to compromise.
And I was also wondering whether for the Republican side, we just got done with this election, so people will not appreciate they want to bring up another one. But the strategies on the Republican side, thinking about the presidential race in 2016, I wonder if that would have an effect on the moves that they make and their incentives to cooperate, because they're obviously going to be thinking about this will be, in a sense, an open seat then. We know that Biden isn't going to be running for president. So how would that influence their decision-making, do you think?
Well, I think it's fortunate that it's unlikely that any of the folks at the top of the Republican leadership in Congress are likely to be candidates for president. You're not going to see Mitch McConnell or John Boehner running for president, probably not Eric Cantor. So they do have some ability to maneuver in ways that don't risk them getting boxed in when it comes to Republican primary politics 3 years from now. And I think that's a very good thing for these negotiations.
And I'm going off in a little bit different direction here, but I want to connect this to the 2016 again. The fact that Obama now has a second term and we've had this election, how does that set up the kinds of candidates that would be best suited in 2016? Because those jockeyings are going to start in about a year, really, or maybe even tomorrow. So.
Right. On the Democratic side, you've got two giant centers of gravity that need to kind of move out before any real jockeying can occur in earnest. One of them is Hillary Clinton, who is going to be stepping down as Secretary of State and has not said definitively whether or not she's going to run. I happen to think she won't, but that's worth virtually nothing. I think she genuinely hasn't decided. And you note that it's unlikely that Vice President Biden will run. I'm not sure that Washington believes that it's a lock certainty that he won't.
Oh.
And so I think those two need to be clear about their intentions before other folks like Governor Cuomo, Governor O'Malley, maybe Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, can start to position themselves to run. They could do things like appear at Jefferson Jackson dinners in Des Moines, but they can't really do anything in earnest till that happens. For Republicans, the jockeying will begin right away, but they will be polite about it. No one's going to form an exploratory committee in November of this year, but you will see the leading lights in Republican politics, Marco Rubio, perhaps Chris Christie, John Thune, the senator from South Dakota. Some of those guys are going to be doing some of those same kind of things, talking to donors and lining up their staff and preparing.
Well, let's go back to this fiscal cliff problem we were talking about before. If you had to put a percentage likelihood on us driving off of it, what would it be?
40. I think that the question, one question in Washington is whether it's a fiscal cliff or a fiscal slope. Mm-hmm. If, in fact, no deal is struck by midnight on December 31st and, for example, the Bush tax cuts expire, the unemployment insurance expires, the alternative minimum tax takes effect and the estate tax expires, what will happen? And some in Washington are arguing that really nothing will happen for a while, that the Wall Street will react very negatively, world markets will gyrate, but that'll be temporary. And in fact, once everybody gets their act together and they pass something, everything will settle down and tax rates will be restored. That's one theory. The other theory is that we will dive into a global economic recession if we go off the fiscal cliff. When you combine that with trouble in Europe and a weak global economy, that it's just one more straw that'll break the camel's back. So no one really knows, but I think the possibility is far higher than zero that we go off.
Let's think about the president's second term for a second. Do you think that he'll have more limited policy ambitions beyond addressing the deficit and the debt, which are, of course, huge things? I guess another way to put this, perhaps, is assuming that the economy continues to recover and we don't go over the cliff, or if we go over the cliff, it is more of a slope. Will we see something akin to a Clinton second term, or will we see really, really big initiatives on things like immigration and climate change?
Well, I think it'll be more like Clinton. These folks have studied their history pretty carefully in the Obama team. They understand that they can't reach for any more giant brass rings the way they did in the first administration, where they had to do things that they weren't planning on, such as the stimulus to save the economy, and things that they were planning on, like healthcare reform and Wall Street reform. So those are the big initiatives of the Obama presidency, the really, really big initiatives. I think if they are able to cut a grand bargain on taxes, entitlements, and the like, that'll be a big initiative too, but it won't be purely of their making. It won't be generated in the White House and driven by the White House. I think, as you point out, the other two big areas that they want to make big progress are immigration and climate change. But my guess is immigration will be a relatively scaled back attempt, something that looks somewhat like what President George W. Bush had proposed. Republicans are certainly going to be more eager to get involved with that now that they have gotten their clocks cleaned among Latinos and Hispanics. And then climate change, our guess is that you will not see a massive, sweeping, economy-wide bill like cap and trade or a carbon tax, and instead it'll be a series of small to medium-sized measures.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Matt Bennett, Senior Vice President at Third Way Think Tank in Washington, D.C. Well, let's move into the weeds a little bit here. As a former White House insider, could you tell me what will go on inside the White House during the next few months? It's not a transition period with a new president, but there is certainly something of a transition period to a second term with reshuffling and reorganization. So what will be happening there?
It's already underway. The president's staff, led by a longtime staffer, the man who was his chief of staff in the Senate, Pete Rouse, has been undergoing a review. They are trying to decide what they're going to do with cabinet officials first and with senior White House aides. What you will see, I think, is an exodus of most of the first-term cabinet. We know that Treasury Secretary Geithner basically has his bags sitting on the front stoop. He couldn't get out of there fast enough. He may stay for the fiscal cliff negotiations or until his successor is in place, but he wants to leave for sure. Secretary Clinton has announced that she's leaving as soon as she has a successor in place. And then beyond that, Secretary Chu in Energy, Secretary Salazar in Interior, Attorney General Holder at Justice Department, and certainly Secretary Panetta at the Defense Department are all either eager to or planning on leaving. So you'll see replacements in those jobs. Many of those jobs will be filled by former elected officials who are close to the president, and some will be filled by current White House aides. The going rumor is that current White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew will move over to Treasury, a job he's suited for as a two-time OMB director. And then there'll be jobs like Jack's that will have to be filled either by insiders or people close to the president. One thing we've learned about Obama is he likes his White House to be staffed by people he knows very well and is very comfortable with. It's one reason that Bill Daley, somebody he knew but wasn't in the inner circle, didn't really work out as chief of staff. So look for someone to be promoted from within.
Any probability or incentive that either the White House or Congress will want to pick a fight over any of these new appointments? That is sometimes when you see a lot of the issues politically get crystallized in one person in terms of an appointment.
It's possible. It really depends on who he appoints. If it's somebody that Republicans are happy about, then you'll probably see them sail through the Senate pretty easily. If he appoints, for example, Susan Rice, who's the U.N. ambassador and someone very close to the president, to be Secretary of State, which is widely rumored, she will face real tough questions from Republicans in the Senate about her comments on the Sunday shows in the week after Benghazi, the attack on the Americans in Libya. Beyond that, it is unlikely that Republicans are going to want to pick fights over nominees. These are fights that they really can't win. They only have 46 Senate seats, and so it's unlikely they're going to try to stop anybody.
And you mentioned Benghazi. That certainly was something the Republicans tried to make one of the central issues in the campaign and I think failed in doing so. Have we pretty much heard the last of that as a partisan issue, or is that going to keep going?
No. I think that what you'll see is Chairman Issa in the House Oversight Committee, who is a very, very strident partisan Republican, will have a series of hearings about Benghazi. I don't know what his colleagues in the Foreign Affairs Committee will do, but I'm confident that the House Republicans will try to keep this ball in the air.
Now, your White House background also includes working with governors. You did that for Clinton. And certainly questions about the relation between the state and federal government have figured very prominently in Obama's first term, and they figured prominently during the election. So how do you see those relationships playing out in a second term? Anything we should be looking for?
Yes. I think that one of the enormous questions facing the leaders in the fiscal cliff negotiations is whether they can and will grapple with the question of entitlement reform. And, of course, When it comes to Medicaid, which is one of the biggest entitlements, that is a shared responsibility of the federal government and the states, and it is the biggest issue between and sticking point among the states and the federal government. So what you will see is in very increased level of activity by governors lobbying their senators and House members to hold the line on certain changes that they would either like or dislike. And you'll see requests for a series of waivers from Medicaid rules that you always have and that will probably pick up as they try to do reform.
Well, I wanted to follow up on the Medicaid because that I always thought that was an underreported aspect of the health care reform, but half of the new coverage is going to come from that Medicaid expansion. It's quite large. There have been some governors that have said, we are not going to take up the national government's offer on this, and that was the one piece of the reform that the Supreme Court did weigh in on and say, you know, you can't threaten the entire federal government's subsidy if you refuse to do the expansion. So how do you see that piece going forward, the Medicaid aspect of health care reform? Will it be wrapped up in this more general phenomenon of asking for waivers, or will some of these governors actually say, you know what, we're not taking the money?
Yes, I think some of them will say that. Governor Perry in Texas has said it, along with a few others. It's going to be tough on these guys, though. I mean, the federal portion of the new money is 90%. I mean, they could do a lot of good for the people of their states with that money. And I think it's going to be very difficult for Rick Perry to explain to the people of Texas why he's not taking a whole bunch of free money. So my guess is that those governors will back down, and when the health care bill goes fully in effect by 2014, they'll start taking the money.
So some of that was bluster, maybe thinking that perhaps Romney might get elected and it'd be part of that piece?
Exactly right. I think now that it's clear that the American the Affordable Care Act is going to remain law, you'll see a change of tune even among the most partisan of governors.
Well, let's get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I would say it is extraordinarily busy middle age.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Probably coming down too hard on my kids when I first walk in the door about their homework, but the kind of anxiety to get things in order.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think the incredible joy that it brings to create something. I never consider myself an entrepreneur, but helping to create Third Way and building a 40-person institution has brought real rewards I didn't anticipate.
That was Matt Bennett. Matt, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. Conversations in the public interest.